Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder that we are Zooming the show on Sunday afternoon. Normally, I begin every show, and I have, except for one day, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I'm going to ask for a point of personal privilege. I want to read you something today. I went to a friend's sister's funeral. And I didn't really know the sister, but she's a very good friend. So I wanted to attend to show my support. And the family is Scott. They're Scottish. So there was lots of bagpipes and poetry. And it was just very, very heady, emotional event. But the thing that blew my mind was when she asked her brother to read the college application essay for his young 17-year-old son, who has not yet been admitted. And he read the essay out loud. And by the end, he was weeping. I was weeping. It captured really kind of the moment we are living in. And I called him up and said, can I read Sam McKinnon's essay? And so everyone, here you go. I am at home between the trees, among tall grass and in shallow streams. Almost all of my life has been spent in these places, on a small farm, in the rural reaches of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, a place so isolated from the rest of the world that it feels like nothing so much as a land plucked out of time. It is hard land, and my home struggles, clinging desperately to a dry, sandy soil that resents its settlement and rejects cultivation. The winters may be long and cold, and the closest town with a four-digit population may be an hour's drive away. But there is a beauty to this place that cannot be denied. It is organic, untouched, natural. Birdsong is difficult to avoid, and all the stars are visible on clear nights. I cannot help but think that it is not a place that belongs to people, just one where we manage to live. One evening, as I was driving my family's weather-beaten car home from practice, I looked out the window and saw the shell of a building, an old motel, windowless, and overgrown with ivy, sitting on the side of a road pockmarked with potholes across from a steepy and rocky beach. I had seen it 100 times already, maybe 1,000. I took this route to school, to buy groceries, to visit friends. But today, with the sun setting on the horizon and the trees casting long shadows over the road, I pulled over. I don't know what possessed me to do it, but as I approached the corpse of the building, I was struck with a sudden and violent realization. This place, my home, was dying. The factories left long before my time, gone when the mines dried up. Lumber was no longer in demand. People stopped moving north, and there was no one to replace the folks that died or moved away. When the people started to leave, so did the businesses, the grocers, the restaurants, the department stores. They began to pack up and head for greener pastures. My home is beautiful, but it is a lonely place, and it is not long for this earth. Soon afterwards, I was on the road again and found myself filled with a growing desire to drive until I arrived someplace new, somewhere that I had never seen before, a place where nothing would be familiar. I realized then that I could count the number of times I had left my state on 2 hands. I had hardly experienced anything outside of my immediate surroundings, besides what I could scrounge from books and movies. I was filled with a certainty that I needed to leave, to experience the world, to escape my comfortable honeyed trap. That epiphany is held with me to this day. This place is my home, and I will miss it. But if I don't leave now, I don't think I will ever get away. I will flee from it, and when I return to visit, I am determined that it will be with new eyes, and I hope as a better person. So he read his son's essay, and it just felt like the despair of Northern New Hampshire. It felt like the despair of so many Rust Belt towns. It felt like the frustration of the manufacturing jobs that left and never came back. And you know, the coal miners who know that coal is ending, and what do they do? And what do they replace it with? And they're too old to run away. They're not 17. But as I was thinking of this, you guys, I just thought in so many ways, he was describing sort of this incredible angst. In some ways, I'm going to go to you, Dean Spiliotis. Donald Trump tapped into that sense of abandonment in 2016, and it was successful. Hillary Clinton didn't address it. For whatever reason, the Democratic Party talks a lot about, you know, the working class and the lower class and people losing their jobs, but they haven't quite come up with a solution or an answer. And as I read this, I keep thinking, what does this mean about the agenda for 2020? Will Biden get it? And will he hear this young man? Because the young man is seeing what a lot of people are seeing, which is this sort of death of this industrial society that has never quite yet morphed into something new. Dean?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's a lovely piece by the student, really quite evocative. It's funny you mentioned this because I was just listening to a demographic discussion over the weekend in which the analysts were talking about the switch that has taken place in which working class white voters have increasingly gravitated to the Republican Party in recent cycles, a lot of it driven by cultural reasons and identity, but nonetheless, and then we've seen at the same time, college-educated whites who were often Republicans increasingly become the voters for the Democratic Party. And so you had this remarkable transition. It's not the first time it happened in our history, and it will probably switch back again at some other point in time. You know, I think Biden certainly in some sense has staked his candidacy, and to the extent that he's having success in places like Pennsylvania and the upper Midwest, is in some sense trying to take back some of those voters, some of the folks who feel alienated and, you know, feel that they have legitimate grievances against the way, you know, federal government policy has hurt them over an extended period of time. You know, President Trump still resonates with some of those folks. I think it's a lot harder for him to run as an outsider as much as he's trying. The other thing that's been pointed out is that this time around, you know, Trump once again is running on a list of grievances. But unlike 2016, when in many respects, as you said, he was connecting with these folks and speaking on their behalf, his grievances are much more personal this time. And so in some sense, he's lost a little bit of that, ability to connect. This is going to be the big question of this election. You know, is Joe Biden able to, you know, telling his story about, you know, being born in Scranton and, you know, his own upbringing, whether that is sufficient to overcome some of the real cultural barriers that are still there among working class white voters who just see the whole progressive agenda as kind of urban and other and focused on racial diversity and not on their core economic interests. And that's the big challenge, I think, for Biden.
And let me apologize. It's our Rethink the Week, and I didn't introduce my panel. We were just hearing from Dean Spiliotis. He's a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. Robert Hennelly, Bob Hennelly, is with the Chief Leader at Stuck Nation. He writes for Salon.com, InsiderNJ.com. He's kind of our go-to union guy. And Stephen Pimpare is a Carsey Institute Fellow. He also teaches at UNH Manchester. His area of expertise is an area that unfortunately is growing, poverty and homelessness and all those other things. And I just want to welcome this great panel to the program. So as I'm listening to you, Dean, and I know I heard that too. That was, I think, the introduction to a conversation with the New Yorker. I think that was where I was listening to it. But I saw something also fascinating that I want to share with you because I was sort of surprised by this tweet. And I'm gonna turn to you, Stephen Pimpare. And the tweet was a quote from Frederick Douglass, all right? But it came from a guy who doesn't like Joe Biden. Okay, Matt Stoller, who's he wants to bust the monopolies. He's an antitrust guy. He's got this thing called Big. Matt Stoller is fabulous. He's just really great when it comes to this issue. And he's a little bit leery of Joe Biden. Okay, he's very leery of Joe Biden. But he wrote something really fascinating with this tweet. And I was actually happy that it was his. So here's the Frederick Douglass quote. Viewed from the genuine abolition ground, Mr. Lincoln seemed tardy, cold, dull, and indifferent. But measuring him by the sentiment of his country, a sentiment he was bound as a statesman to consult, he was swift, zealous, radical, and determined. Ooh, ooh, And I just thought that was such an interesting quote, knowing, you know, who was quoting him, Matt Stoller, but that is true, that for those of us who want change yesterday, Biden seems to be a little bit lethargic. He seems to be a little bit willing to sort of do kumbaya with people you shouldn't even be talking to. And yet I think he is prepared to make some swift change. And maybe we just need to sort of understand that, because that's important in order for what Dean was just saying. Are we going to be seen as the party of the elite? Or are we going to realize that in the end, what makes this country great is not the elite, but the sort of the working folks that really are the foundation of America?
This is one of those places where our relentless focus on the presidency and presidential politics gets in our way of understanding where the sources of power are and where the motivation for change emanates. Famous instance, right, of FDR early in his first term, Tang, I forget sort of who he's talking to in this particular instance, but is saying, fine, I agree with you, now go out and make me do it. Right? A recognition from FDR that if he was going to be able to even move a large congressional majority toward those New Deal policies, that there needed to be external pressure forcing the system to act in a way that it is not set up to do and typically does not want to do. Should we find ourselves with a Biden presidency and Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate, it's going to be a similar kind of story, right? His instinct throughout has in his entire career has always been to hold the center, right? And that it strikes me that this is not a moment when you think of the pandemic, when you think of the economy, when you think of climate change, when you think of rising white nationalism, this is perhaps not a moment maybe for moderation, but we can't count on him to move away from that. We're gonna have to count on others within Congress, and particularly that sustained movement activity outside Congress, to force that action.
So, Bob, actually, what you are just saying, Stephen, is something I've always told when I give speeches around the country or I give speeches around the state. I always said our job is to give these politicians cover. And what do I mean by that? My job is to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and explaining. And by doing that, then I kind of pull them in, suck them in. I've given them cover to begin to take the kinds of actions they need to take. So, for example, with Joe Biden, I mean, Joe Biden wants to cling to the center, Bob. The center is so far to the right that even true center would seem liberal today to some extent. So not only do I think the center is important, But I actually think that America is not where the Democratic Party is. I think America is more, I hate to say this, where Arnie is. I think we're more of the radical middle. I think we want to be able to go to a doctor when we're sick. I think we want to be able to send our kid to college. I think we want a job that pays the bills. I think we want to live in a community where we can afford the house and not feel like we've been driven out. I think we want to have not clean water and clean air, but we want to have a coastline that doesn't disappear because of climate change or fires that mean that we can never breathe the air again. So I think in a lot of ways, it is about sort of being out there, but it is about establishing what is, I think, a more real middle than where the middle is today. Bob?
I think part of this comes from the disconnect, and you can hear it when you describe these things that are very real to you and vivid. There's a kind of stress to your voice because you sense that there's this kind of an imminent threat that's upon us. Yes. And yet, the way that the corporate media digests all this is that we're maintaining. So anything that is a threat to what is stability is a radical concept. And I submit to you that with the death of local reporting that's happened over my lifetime, what's happened is we have what they call, when they tabletop exercises, a lack of situational awareness. The dislocation that the young man so vividly portrays is not really, you know, something that people get. In power centers. And that's where our politics are increasingly defined. And so the dislocation that Donald Trump tapped into, the media, the corporate media, I-95 corridor, was largely disconnected from. They had already made a multilateral kind of assumption about prosperity that President Obama, who was certainly had much to recommend him, but the recovery that they speak of, that they're even building on now rhetorically, was hollow, which is why close to 1 million African-American voters in those key jurisdictions, in those 200 counties, those 20 congressional districts had voted twice for Hope and Change, and then either didn't show up or switched to Trump because they didn't get Hope and Change. And America is still right now ignoring it. I'll give you a key example. With all the ink that's been spilled and all of the internet programming around the ACA and the imminent confirmation of the judge that they're trying to force through to destroy the ACA, no one has discussed that I've seen about the fact that the immediate effect of getting rid of the ACA will strip the protection from the first responders and healthcare professionals and their families who are at most at risk of being infected by COVID. Those are the police officers that Trump can't get close enough to. Once we lose those, the pre-existing condition protections, we'll be losing all of those valiant people and their families who are implicated by this once in a century health crisis.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So Dean, this again goes right back into the next article that I just read this morning. White House chief of staff admits we're not going to control the pandemic as cases soar. Holy crap, Dean. And so his whole answer is he wants to conflate it once again with just the flu. He wants to say the vaccine is tomorrow and that we've got these treatments that mean you won't die. What is shocking to me is that even if we got a vaccine tomorrow, most Americans won't get the vaccine until probably the fall of next year. We just did an amazing interview with a guy about vaccines. Do you know what a good vaccine is? Anywhere from 30 to 70% accuracy in being able to prevent you from getting COVID. 30%. If I only can control 30% of the population after they get a vaccine, that means 70% of the population could get COVID. But that's considered an okay vaccine. That's the range. And the ability to get it is probably not going to be until sometime in the fall of next year, if it even happens. And then who gets the treatment? We, at the end of that article that I was just reading you from Slate.com, one of the great, you know, sort of doctors was saying that we're going to see the number of cases spike and the number of deaths spike. Deaths spike. So they have made the decision that we are expendable. And if we are expendable, then it's not only us that are expendable, it's the nurses and doctors that are expendable. And then if they lose the ACA, then it's the nurses, the doctors, and the pre-existing conditions that are expendable. I mean, look, this is like a domino theory, Dean. You hit one and everything falls down. And I wish somebody would actually show a domino as to what this means, because it comes right out of the mouth of the chief of staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that interview, that was an interview with Jake Tapper on CNN this morning. Just a fascinating interview. And, you know, you have a number of episodes that are coming together now at the end of the presidential campaign that really give the administration almost kind of a fatalistic feel on the future course of COVID. You have President Trump, if you've seen him on the stump the last few days, you know, joking about COVID. That's all anybody wants to talk about. He said that we're turning the corner beautifully. The numbers look great as we hit the two highest days of infection rate of the entire pandemic. The last 2 days, up over 80,000 new infections a day. You have that. You have Vice President Pence now has his chief of staff and I think four others. All infected. And he's still campaigning without a mask. And then you have Chief of Staff Meadows basically saying, you know, we'll eventually have the therapeutics and the vaccine. And you know, it is true that medical professionals do say at some point it will be primarily more of a nuisance rather than a potential threat to your life when we'll have therapeutics, we'll have vaccines. But, you know, that could be a couple of years away in reality by the time by the time it feels like we're back to normal. So the combination of all these things really, really makes it feel like they've just kind of thrown in the towel on trying to get people to adopt mitigation. And I do wonder, even if Joe Biden wins the election, the environment on things like mask wearing and social distancing and small gatherings, it seems pretty much shot at this point. I don't know how you ever turn that around. It's been so, the well has been so poisoned, so to speak. So it's just been remarkable. This last week, it just seems like the administration is increasingly just kind of, you know, given up on anything other than eventually promising a vaccine and therapeutics.
But you know why, Stephen? And the reason is this, is that that's why Donald Trump is doing all these events and he's dancing and he's saying nothing about it and he's not wearing a mask, because he's saying to you, you're just like me. Ah, if you get COVID, look at how good I am. Look at me, I'm dancing. I'm doing five events a week. So guess what? If you get COVID, not a problem. 99% of you will be just like me. So in a lot of ways, he is their poster child for what the chief of staff said. We're not going to be dealing with the pandemic, but then Donald Trump is out there saying, but don't worry. Okay. So, you know, even though we're seeing deaths, he's trying to say, in a way, it's almost like the number of deaths are faux news. It's like fake news for him. And that's what's so scary. What I'm hoping is that Biden uses what the chief of staff said, uses what the reality is, and goes down to Florida, where all those older people are that are still, you know, whatever they are at those big resorts that they go and campaign in, and use what the chief of staff said, because they will die. They will die. They may have access to good healthcare, but not good enough to get them through this and get them through this alive. I'm hoping that is the antidote to the chief of staff, is that it brings in those numbers, especially of older people and Blacks and Hispanics, which are clearly those that are the most expendable.
No, I would agree with everything that Dean said, except that I don't think this doesn't strike me as them having given up, right? Because I've not seen any particular evidence that they ever actually tried, right? I mean, the evidence on, I mean, I'm serious, right? The evidence on the record is that from the beginning, right, we now know from the Bob Woodward tapes, right, is that they understood the severity, at least for that moment, right, in end of January, early February, understood the severity of what was coming for us, determined that it was not in their interest for there to be a crisis during the election year, and have spent the rest of the year looking for ways to deny that it is a problem. And we are now to the point where they have successfully quieted all of those internal voices who are trying to work from within the system and behave as public health professionals.
So you write a lot about workers and union folks, Bob, and I keep thinking about who is expendable here. And it is the bus drivers, and it is the EMTs, and it is the cops, and it is the nurses, and it is the doctors. I remember I wrote something on my Facebook page this morning. Remember when they tore Barack Obama a new you-know-what because he promised everyone that the ACA would mean you'd still be able to keep your doctor and you wouldn't lose your doctor? Well, at the rate that Trump and Pence are going, you're not gonna have to worry about losing your doctor. You're gonna kill your doctor. Right. You know, you're gonna kill your nurse. You're gonna kill your EMT. And the reason I say that is, if we are gonna see a flood of cases coming in, you are gonna overwhelm the system. The system won't have enough protective equipment. The system won't have enough, you know, things to be able to serve them. You are going to hurt the very people that you so depend on, right, which is the medical community. And we need to tie this, you know, waving the white flag on the pandemic with these incredibly spiking numbers by saying, you might as well just put a gun to their head, because you are shooting and killing people who are here to care for you.
From the very beginning, the Trump administration adopted the herd immunity Malthusian approach that Boris Johnson picked up and then came away from after it almost killed him. I would also say there's some historic precedent for this, that we did have Woodrow Wilson, who back during the Spanish flu pandemic didn't want that referenced either, because we were fighting a war for democracy.
Yeah, exactly. All right. We need to go to a break. We'll be right back. And when we come back, we really need to talk about what's happening with this election. We need to talk about turnout. We need to talk about all the appeals that are going to be rushing to the Supreme Court. This is Rethink the Week. It's The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Monday edition. We'll be right back.
You'd think that making voting faster and easier to do would be a no-brainer, and nonpartisan too. But some states are trying new ID laws that are seriously flawed. Trotting out that same old tired myth, but voter fraud is a fraud. These types of laws discriminate, there's evidence to confirm it. And why can't you use a student ID, but you can use a gun permit? They're trying voter intimidation tactics that have been outlawed. Voter suppression is a real problem, but voter fraud is a fraud. The GOP began this myth with laws they tried to pass. Now baseless fears of election rigging may bite them in the ass. There's even been attempts at illegal poll watching with its thinly veiled racist nod over something that's nearly non-existent. 'Cause voter fraud is a fraud. For example, you're more likely to win the lottery or be struck by lightning or be elected as president, which in many cases is frightening, or give birth to quadruplets or win an Olympic gold medal or be hurt by a pogo stick or an exploding Rachel Ray tea kettle. Being attacked by a shark is more likely, also flying to the moon. Being canonized or being killed by a vending machine or balloon or by flammable pajamas or mad cow disease. Voter fraud is less likely than all of these. Such ludicrous excuses this argument is made of, which makes you think which part of democracy are they afraid of? Disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of voters, trampling on rights so roughshod. When restrictions are so broad, we can see through the facade of this right-wing goon squad as they desperately maraud till we're frankly slack-jawed. Okay, I'm out of rhymes. 'Cause voter fraud is a fraud. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. Our guests are Robert Hennelly. He writes for Salon.com, the chief leader. You can find him at Stuck Nation. He also writes for Insider NJ. And I want to welcome Bob back to the program. Thank you, Bob, for showing up.
Thanks.
And we have Dean Spiliotis. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog that's entitled nhpoliticalcapital.com. You can also hear him fairly regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome back, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
And Stephen Pimper is a professor at UNH Manchester. He is a senior fellow at the Carsey Institute. His area of expertise is poverty and homelessness and all those things that we're beginning to see spike as a result of the fact that we haven't gotten a second relief bill. And I'm sure, Stephen, the consequences of this are enormous. So I want to talk a little bit about the election and what's happening. And so one of my fears about Amy Coney Barrett getting on the bench, and I guess she'll be maybe on the bench by Monday night. I mean, I think they'll take the vote and he'll come in and he'll swear, get her on and it's over. And it's not about the ACA. It's about all the appeals that are going to be going up as quickly as possible to the Supreme Court. And we saw one situation where I think it was a 4-4 and it ended up that it was at Pennsylvania or one of those cases. But there are so many cases right now in the hopper. And while it seems like there's only 11 or 10 days left, 11 or 10 days is an enormous amount of time when you're talking about this election and the consequences of this and the lines and the drop boxes and the post office and who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote. These are critical times and Amy will be on the bench. Stephen?
So there are, last I looked, this is combining both state and federal cases, something on the order of 380 election-related lawsuits moving their way through the courts in 44 separate states. Overwhelming majority of those efforts to strike down, efforts to make it easier to vote, given that we are in the midst of a global pandemic, wanting to deny that or not. there's I'm gonna put on the political science hat here for a second. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Paper number 78 devotes a lot of attention to talking about the Supreme Court and talking about the power of the courts. And the, you know, he's making this, he's trying to convince people that they shouldn't be worried about court power. He doesn't believe this, but that's a story for another day. So he's saying, you know, you don't have to worry about this institution, right? Because it has neither force nor will, he says, neither the power of the sword nor the purse, right? And he means that it has no independent budget. It's entirely dependent on other institutions in order to fund its actions. And it has no freestanding army, so it has no ability to enforce its decisions. So it seems to me that one of the things that is missing from conversations now about the power of the court and should there be a democratic trifecta, should they expand the number of seats on both the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts, is that what's missing from that conversation is the other option, which is to simply argue that the 1803 decision of Marbury versus Madison, where the court said, we get to strike down unconstitutional law, is for a President Joe Biden to stand up and say, yeah, you know what? That was wrongly decided. That is illegitimate. And we reject your assertion of power to overcome democratic decision-making processes. Mitch McConnell wants to play hardball. That's the next stage of playing hardball, is to reject the absurd notion that the United States Supreme Court should have the kind of power that it has, which no other superior court on the planet grants to itself.
Woo! I haven't heard that argument, but it's novel and it's interesting, because one of the things I'm thinking about is, I thought you were going to go down another track, and Bob, the track I thought he was going to go down is that when you look at election law is the province of states.
Right.
It's not the province of the federal government. And Amy's going to be interesting, since she is a constitutionalist and she is a purist. So how is she going to thread that needle? Because if she threads that needle, then the states get to decide and not the Supreme Court. They have to wash their hands of it. They have to walk away and say, it ain't my job. And so it's going to put Amy in this really interesting box. Which Amy is going to show up? The one that's the handmaiden for Donald Trump and will do what he wants, basically to sort of undermine the election? Or is she going to be what she claims to be, which is a sort of constitutional purist?
Originalist.
It's going to be interesting to me to see how she responds, or is she going to punt because she is able, if she wants to say, I cannot be involved in these cases because I was assigned this position as a result of this election. She won't do that. I know, look at Stephen's face going, no. But she does have another cover, and the originalist is the cover.
Right. Am I right? And I guess that one of the things that we see this recent decision, which was the Pennsylvania decision, went in the direction of voter access.
Yes.
Supporting the decisions in right. But in Alabama, they rejected the idea of having drive-through drop-off balloting. And so it is going to hinge on these very nuanced points about the nature of the authority of the different players that are in court and who has the authority that is most authentically tied to this original division of labor. There's also one of the aspects of this is this decision about the degree to which she has to recuse herself, which I also find very, that's just kind of, it's up to them, apparently. That's one of the things we've learned in this whole confirmation process, is that while we have this elaborate inspector generals and this architecture for everybody else in the mix here, although it's been proven to be largely ineffective with President Trump, at least he can have a bad hair day in terms of public relations. But when it comes to the courts, they themselves determine what's too close for comfort. And that might also, I like Stephen Pair's idea of revisiting the 1803 decision, but also we should look at this thing, because this lack of accountability of the legal system in courts is throughout the country. The abuse that's happened in recent times, and I think I've written a lot about, for instance, issues around child custody and domestic law. Some of the abuses that have happened in the courts are incredible. Look what's happened with the grand jury system, what we saw happen in Kentucky with the Breonna Taylor case.
Exactly.
And there's a need for a major makeover here, and I don't think the judicial branch has gotten the attention required.
So, Stephen, Elizabeth Warren talked corruption, 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 but she was actually not talking about the courts. But I think in an interesting way, because of what the Federalist Society has been able to do, the fact that there is no sort of code of conduct for Supreme Court justices, there is for other justices, but not for Supreme Court justices, that now with the connection that we saw with the senator from Rhode Island, what's his name, Whitehouse, and who actually showed the money trail to the Supreme Court, now we can actually use the word corruption and actually talk about the black robes. Stephen, what do you think? I mean, you raised that question about whether we should overturn that, you know, 250-year-old decision. I'm looking at what Sheldon Whitehouse did, which showed that connection. We know the Federalist Society has made most of the appointments to the United States Supreme Court, and we know exactly what their agenda is. So it's not exactly the people's court. And I am wondering if this is a time to raise some ethical issues. And the Supreme Court should embrace ethics. They shouldn't reject it. They should say, yes, we should be players too. Don't you think so, Stephen?
Well, you know, I mean, sure, who wants to argue against ethics, right?
Exactly.
I think sitting at the heart of this problem, right, is that we have erected this utterly absurd notion that somehow the institution of the judiciary is apolitical, right? That these are these neutral actors who occupy this view from nowhere somehow, right? They've got this ability to rule on these abstract, neutral ways. And after all one needs to do is take the text of the Constitution, the text of the law, line them up against the other, and if there is a contradiction, there you go. I mean, to state that way is to demonstrate how deeply absurd the notion is. Of course, they are political actors. They would not be fighting as hard as they are to get the least experienced jurist in, what, 60 years on the bench. She is how old? 45 years old? 50 years old? Right? I will be long dead, and she will still be making decisions on that court. If she were a neutral actor rather than a political ideologue, as all justices ultimately are, because there is no way not to be.
All right, Ken, you wanted to weigh in?
Yeah, just to pick up on Stephen's point here, the day before they ascend to the Supreme Court, they were a human being, and just like you and me, and they have flaws, and they have biases, and they have ideological bent. The day after they're sworn in, they don't magically become God. You know, look at our presidents, you know, they don't magically change from being ordinary human beings. They still have flaws when they get to be presidents. And the conversation that frequently occurs, when I hear politicians, including people who are seeking Senate confirmation, like people who want to be judges, the first thing I think is that what they're saying might not be true. You have to assess whether it's true. Do they have some kind of other motive? You can't say, well, she said she was an originalist, so maybe she'll actually do that and we can give her political cover. Well, no, I don't think we need to take for granted that she is going to be ethically and morally bound to follow whatever she said about originalism. I mean, probably she is generally an originalist, but if it serves her purposes, she'll use the originalist argument. And if she wants to confirm Donald Trump's grab for keeping power, she will find some other reason to do it. Just briefly, the other thing I wanted to say, Stephen, is on Marbury versus Madison. I don't know that Biden should just come in and say, it's so much garbage, let's throw it away. Maybe he can try to interpret Marbury differently or bring up some other court precedents to change the way we are currently interpreting.
And I wouldn't recommend something like that, you know, the evening of the inauguration. But I do think as part of a larger conversation about the ways in which those Madisonian institutions have demonstrated themselves to not be able to function in an era of hyper-polarized partisan politics, right? So what do we do about those basic institutional problems, the nature of the court being one of them?
And I want to go back to something that Ken said, that they were human beings before they go on the bench, and suddenly they go on the bench and they're like superhuman beings and all their flaws must disappear. So Bob, don't you think there should be sort of this idea that if you're going to be put on the bench for life, then the assumption is we need to have a set of rules for you. because how do we really remove you? I mean, we could impeach you, but the likelihood of that is pretty negligible. But it's kind of like when I look at corporations. Corporations now exist in perpetuity because they have limited liability. Well, there should be an obligation on them to sort of behave properly. I'm not going to give you this and then have you shaft me. You know what I mean? You exist because I created you. And if I created you, I can put limits on you. Well, the same thing is true with these judges. If you're going to be put on this bench for life, then there has to be some sort of rules of the game that we all can agree to so we know how you behave and we understand what the sort of the ethical parameters are of this.
Well, one of the brilliant, I think it's Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island who wrote the book, yeah. Captured, is what you're referring to.
Yes.
And I was just reading it because I was doing deep research for a piece related to how Donald Trump executed a regulatory capture of Atlantic City and all the politicians and all the regulators and all the people that set up the bulk work against the mafia ended up going to work for Donald Trump. That is what's happened in the United States over the last 30 to 40 years is the regulatory capture of the entire economy.
Exactly.
On a breathtaking scale. And what the senator does for us is takes us through that and shows slide by slide, date by date, how they graded a situation where the Chamber of Commerce, doing multinationals bidding increasingly, not small main street businesses, but multinational corporations, doing their bidding so that this corporate legal structure was able to imbue into corporations human rights like unlimited giving for campaign purposes, turning on its head 100 years of precedent. And so this alienation, and this is why we do need a revolution, this alienation of law goes down to the granular level on the street, the way Americans have had to encounter the law in very fundamental ways.
Right.
The abandonment of making sure people have effective counsel
for
everything from foreclosures. I mean, I can't tell you how many stories I've done about people that caught Wells Fargo stealing their home and judges confirmed the theft.
Yeah.
And they just got free with the DOJ getting a big check like the Publishers Clearinghouse to settle a fine.
All right. I want to talk a little bit about the debate because there were two points that came up. One, Joe Biden had to talk about fracking ad nauseum. And the other thing that he was sort of caught in, Dean Spiliotis, was, and Trump assumes it's a caught, was that he had to talk about oil and gas and its future. So I am kind of curious as to whether the Trump campaign thinks that they now have their argument to go into Pennsylvania, to go into Texas, to go into those places and use Joe Biden's words against the oil companies and the refineries and the gas companies and the fracking that's going on in Pennsylvania. Do you think that they have the time? Do you think that they can target the message? Or do you think that the pandemic, Dean, has so blurred everyone's concern right now is that before I worry about oil and gas, I got to make sure I can live and send my kids to school?
Yeah, I think they certainly think it's worth a try. Whether or not they're going to have time at this point, given how many people have already voted and how many people who will have already voted by Election Day, hard to really say. In fairness, Biden hasn't exactly been crystal clear on his position. I mean, it's not an unreasonable assumption to make that any Democratic candidate who is successful in getting the nomination in their party is at some level going to promise a transition away from fossil fuels and an emphasis on alternative sources of energy. But part of Biden's argument was that conceptually, some of the Green Deal makes sense over time, but he has a separate plan. So, you know, part and that's one area where I think in order to make an economic argument, he's tried to be a little bit less progressive as a means of showing people, you know, in the center that he's not going to do anything drastic. I think the argument that Democrats make about moving to alternative energy as a means of guaranteeing many more jobs, there are issues, and Hillary Clinton got caught up in this in coal country in West Virginia. You know, how do you retrain these people? Can you really guarantee them jobs in other emerging technologies, et cetera, et cetera? So my guess is that Trump folks seem to think it's something worth a try. I don't think it's quite as drastic as they're trying to make it sound. I just think it's primarily a function of a lack of clarity on Biden's. I mean, I've seen a half dozen different clips from Biden where he seems to say something different every time. First, he's opposed to fracking, and then it's only fracking on federal lands that he's opposed to. Then he's not going to stop fracking. but he wants to transition away from politics. This has been not his strongest area, but I don't know that it's quite the huge, colossal goof that Republicans are trying to say that it is.
So Stephen, could he actually define what the word phase out means? That you know, we were talking about the young Amy Coney Barrett on the bench, and that you'll be long dead by the time she finishes her term. So maybe what we can say with the phase out is, don't worry, you'll be dead by the time we, you know, get to 2050 or 2040 or whatever it is that there is a phase out. You will have a job. But guess what? As we phase it out, part of the phase out doesn't mean that we turn a switch off. It means we know where the next job is coming from. There is a bridge to the next job. It isn't a door shut, it is a bridge.
And, you know, going back to the conversation we were having earlier, right? It's not Biden who is going to do that work. It's the people internally in the agencies, and it's the external pressure and the internal pressure coming from Congress that is going to push him toward those policies. And if you look at, you know, sort of the original text of what's come to be called the Green New Deal, it is as much a jobs program as it is anything else, right? Recognizing that basic fact. And the other sort of bits of context that, you know, how long have I been complaining about Joe Biden that he is never particularly good about articulating, is that, first of all, you look at the national polling numbers, there's overwhelming public support for transition to alternative sources of fuel. There's widespread recognition among the public that coal and oil and gas are literally at the root of the problem that is going to drive us underwater and to die of heat stroke, right? So that there's public support there. And we have now reached the point where energy produced by solar is the cheapest form of energy being produced today in the United States of America, right? So the economic argument is there. You don't have to make stuff up, right? You really can argue, look, this is one of those cases, we really can have it both ways, right? We can transition to alternative sources of fuel so that we reduce the impact of climate change, and we can also boost the economy and increases the chances that you can earn a living.
So Bob, let me just, I want to take pictures of the following. The one thing I'm grateful for is that Trump supporters have Trump signs and Biden supporters have Biden signs in front of their house. You know what my favorite place is to see solar panels on a Trump house.
Right.
That's what I love. And the reason I love that is that they haven't embraced climate change. They've embraced this, ka-ching, that they want to save money, that this is all about their wallet. This is, you know, I mean, they could care what the scientists say. It's about money. And we just pointed out that solar energy is now cheaper than virtually any kind of fossil fuel. Well, that is my favorite sign. A Trump supporter with solar panels on their roof.
I think that the challenge here is describing the America that is already presenting itself and is going to become more manifestly presented in front of us, which is going to be an aging America, America that's going to be very short of nursing care, a nation with millions of more people that are going to be respiratorily impaired, a country that's going to require, we already have a labor force participation rate, which has sank even further during this period of time. Right. And so we're going to have to come to terms with the fact that people are going to need to be staying at home to take care of people in a way that we've not imagined. We did not take care of the nursing deficit before the pandemic. We've lost 1,000 healthcare professionals just in under three quarters. So the work to be done, it's up to the political process to define and use situational awareness about the real crisis in terms of people power upon us right now and in the years ahead. That's where the new frontier is in hand labor and taking care of each other and universal income to make that possible.
All right, last but not least, there was an amazing story that came out. Trump's order sets the stage for loyalty tests for thousands of feds. And Dean, I'm just going to read you a little bit from this. I wrote, Trump new executive order, also known as only ASS kissers need apply. That's how I framed it. And he writes, with a stroke of his Sharpie, President Trump has launched the biggest effort in history to sweep aside 140 years of federal policy promoting professional expertise in government. It would have a vast impact on government, on its workers, and on the public trust. On Wednesday, when we were all focusing on something else, the president signed an executive order creating a new category of federal employees. Top officials could classify positions as having, quote, a confidential, policy-determining, policymaking or policy advocating character. Then they could sweep employees holding those positions into a new Schedule F, where employees would lose all protections, including those against discrimination, forced reassignments and relocations, and any rights to organize or appeal personnel decisions. And as someone said, the beauty of what he signed on Wednesday was its sheer simplicity. Oh my God, Dean. I mean, talk about politicizing everything. And then if you want to undermine trust, you have just literally spelled it out.
Yeah, well, you know, this I think this is really a manifestation of Trump's paranoia that the bureaucracy, the quote, deep state, has been working across purposes to him all along. He wrote the whole concept of a civil service and a focus on expertise, and that there's continuity in bureaucratic decision making over a long period of time. And sure, you have a layer of political appointees on top, but those change over from administration to administration, but that there's a benefit to this kind of expertise and incremental policy development. Kind of the spiritual godfather of this is really Ronald Reagan in the early 1980s, sort of vertically integrating the bureaucracy along ideological lines and populating it with people who wanted to shrink it from within, particularly on the domestic side, not so much on the military side. But this really goes a step further, and it really speaks to Trump's obsession with loyalty, with the idea that there may be people working to undercut him. We know it's funny because when he was elected in 2016, a lot of people thought, well, you know, the advisors will kind of provide guardrails for him. And, you know, he'll have these smart people who know how government works. Remember when George W. Bush picked Dick Cheney, the idea was that he would have somebody who knows how government works to aid him. Trump very methodically eliminated all those folks one by one. And so now you have people like Grinnell and Chad Wolf and others who are mainly there to do the president's bidding and tell him what he wants to hear.
But he did this. What's so shocking to me is that he did it Wednesday. Like, what's the point? Why are you doing this now? Why aren't you waiting till after the election? Or does he want to eliminate all these people? Let's say Biden gets elected. Does he want to drain the federal swamp as he sees it and basically eliminate all these people before Biden actually gets sworn in? Is this his revenge? So it works either way. If he wins, look at the power he has. He basically gets to make sure that nobody challenges him. If he loses, look at the power he has. He gets to basically pull all these people out before Biden even gets to sort of, you know, say, you know, put his hand on the Bible. The timing of this is so shocking to me because it's so threatening.
Yeah, well, I think on the one hand, if he were to win re-election and do this, then I think that speaks to the potential for what administration might look like 2, 3, 4 years now in terms of policy. If Biden wins, you know, Biden can certainly, I think that no matter what Trump does now, there's going to be a process of rebuilding the bureaucracy. He's hollowed out the State Department. He's hollowed out a number of the other agencies. Positions are unfilled all over the place. So I think if Biden wins, it reduces the long-term impact of this. If he wins and continues to put in place these people who do his bidding, again, it reduces the idea that there are institutional checks or guardrails in place.
All right. So, before I go to Stephen, I want to go to Bob just because this is your area of expertise.
Well, he's made,
go on.
He's made war from the day he came in on the civil service. He went after the American Federation of Government Employees, the National Treasury Employee Union. These things were in place since 1962, since John Kennedy signed collective bargaining agreements. And there's been bipartisan support to create this thing. It goes back to Garfield, when he was assassinated by a patron, a guy who was looking for a job who thought he should have been hired. And I mean, this is something that we've had. We used to sell offices like this, and that's what Trump wants to bring back.
So what I'm trying to figure out, Stephen, is as I'm looking at what Donald Trump is doing, he does say the quiet stuff out loud. And the executive order that he just said, we heard the Republicans say that Obama abused executive power. Obama abused the executive order. This is like an executive order on steroids.
No one ever is persuaded by hypocrisy arguments, and there is no such thing today as a good faith Republican argument. Also, I would also throw into the mix, never ever forget to look for the possible racism angle. right? And if you look at public service jobs, the federal, state, and local level, right, and union positions, that has by and large been the entry point, particularly for Black women entering the middle class, right? So if you can assault unions and you can assault civil service, right? Because if you're in a job that is both unionized and has civil service protection, it is harder to discriminate against you. Right. This is how we have helped build the Black middle class. I don't know that Trump is smart enough to recognize that, but there are people in the administration who are.
Great point.
All right, clip that and make that a commercial. Clip that and make that a commercial right now. I love you guys. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes, Stephen Pimpare. Definitely, I want to book that. That's the best. And of course, he teaches at UNH Manchester. Bob Henley writes for the Chief Leader, Salon.com, at Stuck Nation. And Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. And I want to thank Sam McKinnon for beginning our show with that absolutely beautiful, beautiful
note. Apply to UNH, Sam.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm going to come to UNH. And on that note, we will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao, everyone. Thank you.